as they were scattered. The fact is, I lost them in the crowd soon after dinner, and took refuge here for my sins. They had seats on one of the stands, but of course they couldn't stop quiet. The Duchess never can. She and Miss Bart went off in quest of what they call adventures. Gad, it ain't their fault if they don't have some queer ones. He added tentatively, after pausing to grope for a cigarette. Miss Bart's an old friend of yours, I believe, so she told me. Ah, thanks, I don't seem to have one left. He lit Selden's proffered cigarette, and continued in his high-pitched, drawling tone. None of my business, of course, but I didn't introduce her to the Duchess. Charming woman, the Duchess, you understand. A very good friend of mine, but rather a liberal education. Selden received this in silence, and after a few puffs, Lord Hubert broke out again. Sort of thing one can't communicate to the young lady, though young ladies nowadays are so competent to judge for themselves. But in this case, I'm an old friend too, you know, and there seemed no one else to speak to. The whole situation's a little mixed, as I see it, but there used to be an aunt somewhere, a diffuse and innocent person, who was great at bridging over chasms she didn't see. Ah, in New York, is she? But in New York, such a long way off.
Chapter 2 Miss Bart, emerging late the next morning from her cabin, found herself alone on the deck of the Sabrina. The cushioned chairs, disposed expectantly under the wide awning, showed no signs of recent occupancy, and she presently learned from a steward that Mrs. Dorset had not yet appeared, and that the gentlemen, separately, had gone ashore as soon as they had breakfasted. Supplied with these facts, Lily leaned a while over the side, giving herself up to a leisurely enjoyment of the spectacle before her. Unclouded sunlight enveloped sea and shore in a bath of purest radiancy. The purpling waters drew a sharp white line of foam at the base of the shore. Against its irregular eminences, hotels and villas flashed from the greyish verdure of olive and eucalyptus, and the background of bare and finely penciled mountains quivered in a pale intensity of light. How beautiful it was, and how she loved beauty! She had always felt that her sensibility in this direction made up for certain obtusenesses of feeling of which she was less proud, and during the last 3 months she had indulged it passionately. The Dorsets' invitation to go abroad with them had come as an almost miraculous release from crushing difficulties, and her faculty for renewing herself in new scenes and casting off problems of conduct as easily as the surroundings in which they had arisen made the mere change from one place to another seem not merely a postponement, but a solution of her troubles. Moral complications existed for her only in the environment that had produced them. She did not mean to slight or ignore them, but they lost their reality when they changed their background. She could not have remained in New York without repaying the money she owed to Trenor. To acquit herself of that odious debt, she might even have faced a marriage with Rosedale. But the accident of placing the Atlantic between herself and her obligations made them dwindle out of sight as if they had been milestones and she had travelled past them. Her 2 months on the Sabrina had been especially calculated to aid this illusion of distance. She had been plunged into new scenes and had found in them a renewal of old hopes and ambitions. The cruise itself charmed her as a romantic adventure. She was vaguely touched by the names and scenes amid which she moved, and had listened to Ned Silverton reading Theocritus by moonlight as the yacht rounded the Sicilian promontories, with a thrill of the nerves that confirmed her belief in her intellectual superiority. But the weeks at Cannes and Nice had really given her more pleasure. The gratification of being welcomed in high company and of making her own ascendancy felt there, so that she found herself figuring once more as the beautiful Miss Bart in the interesting journal devoted to recording the least movements of her cosmopolitan companions. All these experiences tended to throw into the extreme background of memory the prosaic and sordid difficulties from which she had escaped. If she was faintly aware of fresh difficulties ahead, she was sure of her ability to meet them. It was characteristic of her to feel that the only problems she could not solve were those with which she was familiar. Meanwhile, she could honestly be proud of the skill with which she had adapted herself to somewhat delicate conditions. She had reason to think that she had made herself equally necessary to her host and hostess, and if only she had seen any perfectly irreproachable means of drawing a financial profit from the situation, there would have been no cloud on her horizon. The truth was that her funds, as usual, were inconveniently low, and to neither Dorset nor his wife could this vulgar embarrassment be safely hinted. Still, the need was not a pressing one. She could worry along, as she had so often done before, with the hope of some happy change of fortune to sustain her. And meanwhile life was gay and beautiful and easy, and she was conscious of figuring not unworthily in such a setting. She was engaged to breakfast that morning with the Duchess of Belcher, and at 12 o'clock she asked to be set ashore in the gig. Before this she had sent her maid to inquire if she might see Mrs. Dorset, but the reply came back that the latter was tired and trying to sleep. Lily thought she understood the reason of the rebuff. Her hostess had not been included in the Duchess's invitation, though she herself had made the most loyal efforts in that direction. But Her Grace was impervious to hints, and invited or omitted as she chose. It was not Lily's fault if Mrs. Dorset's complicated attitudes did not fall in with the Duchess's easy gait. The Duchess, who seldom explained herself, had not formulated her objection beyond saying, "She's rather a bore, you know. The only one of your friends I like is that little Mr. Bry. He's funny." But Lily knew enough not to press the point, and was not altogether sorry to be thus distinguished at her friend's expense. Bertha certainly had grown tiresome since she had taken to poetry and Ned Silverton. On the whole, it was a relief to break away now and then from the Sabrina, and the Duchess's little breakfast, organized by Lord Hubert with all his usual virtuosity, was the pleasanter to Lily for not including her travelling companions. Dorset of late had grown more than usually morose and incalculable, and Ned Silverton went about with an air that seemed to challenge the universe. The freedom and lightness of the ducal intercourse made an agreeable change from these complications, and Lily was tempted, after luncheon, to adjourn in the wake of her companions to the hectic atmosphere of the casino. She did not mean to play. Her diminished pocket money offered small scope for the adventure, but it amused her to sit on a divan under the doubtful protection of the Duchess's back, while the latter hung above her stakes at a neighbouring table. The rooms were packed with the gazing throng, which in the afternoon hours trickles heavily between the tables like the Sunday crowd in a lion house. In the stagnant flow of the mass, identities were hardly distinguishable. But Lily presently saw Mrs. Bry cleaving her determined way through the doors, and in the broad wake she left, the light figure of Mrs. Fisher bobbing after her like a rowboat at the stern of a tug. Mrs. Bry pressed on, evidently animated by the resolve to reach a certain point in the rooms. But Mrs. Fisher, as she passed Lily, broke from her towing line and let herself float to the girl's side. "Lose her?" She echoed the latter's query with an indifferent glance at Mrs. Bry's retreating back. "I dare say, it doesn't matter, I have lost her already." And as Lily exclaimed, she added, "We had an awful row this morning. You know, of course, the Duchess chucked her at dinner last night, and she thinks it was my fault, my want of management. The worst of it is, the message, just a mere word by telephone, came so late that the dinner had to be paid for, and Becassin had run it up. It had been so drummed into him that the Duchess was coming." Mrs. Fisher indulged in a faint laugh at the remembrance. "Paying for what she doesn't get rankles so dreadfully with Louisa. I can't make her see that it's one of the preliminary steps to getting what you haven't paid for. And as I was the nearest thing to smash, she smashed me to atoms, poor dear." Lily murmured her commiseration. Impulses of sympathy came naturally to her, and it was instinctive to proffer her help to Mrs. Fisher. "If there's anything I can do, if it's only a question of meeting the Duchess. I heard her say she thought Mr. Bry amusing." But Mrs. Fisher interposed with a decisive gesture. "My dear, I have my pride, the pride of my trade. I couldn't manage the Duchess, and I can't palm off your arts on Louisa Bry as mine. I've taken the final step. I go to Paris tonight with the Sam Gormers. They're still in the elementary stage. An Italian prince is a great deal more than a prince to them, and they're always on the brink of taking a courtier for one. To save them from that is my present mission." She laughed again at the picture. "But before I go, I want to make my last will and testament. I want to leave you the Brys." "Me?" Miss Bart joined in her amusement. It's charming of you to remember me, dear, but really, you're already so well provided for. Mrs. Fisher flashed a sharp glance at her. Are you, though, Lily? To the point of rejecting my offer? Miss Bart coloured slowly. What I really meant was that the Brys wouldn't in the least care to be so disposed of. Mrs. Fisher continued to probe her embarrassment with an unflinching eye. What you really meant was that you've snubbed the Brys horribly, and you know that they know it. Carrie. Oh, on certain sides, Louisa bristles with perceptions. If you'd even managed to have them asked once on the Sabrina, especially when royalties were coming. But it's not too late, she ended earnestly. It's not too late for either of you. Lily smiled. Stay over, and I'll get the Duchess to dine with them. I shan't stay over. The Gormers have paid for my salon, Lee, said Mrs. Fisher with simplicity. But get the Duchess to dine with them all the same. Lily's smile again flowed into a slight laugh. Her friend's importunity was beginning to strike her as irrelevant. I'm sorry I've been negligent about the Brys, she began. Oh, as to the Brys, it's you I'm thinking of, said Mrs. Fisher abruptly. She paused, and then bending forward with a lowered voice, You know we all went on to Nice last night when the Duchess chucked us. It was Louise's idea, and I told her what I thought of it. Miss Bart assented. Yes, I caught sight of you on the way back at the station. Well, the man who was in the carriage with you and George Dorset, that horrid little Dabham who does society notes from the Riviera, had been dining with us at Nice, and he's telling everybody that you and Dorset came back alone after midnight. Alone? When he was with us? Lily laughed, but her laugh faded into gravity under the prolonged implication of Mrs. Fisher's look. We did come back alone, if that's so very dreadful. But whose fault was it? The Duchess was spending the night at Simier with the Crown Princess. Bertha got bored with the show and went off early, promising to meet us at the station. We turned up on time, but she didn't. She didn't turn up at all. Miss Bart made this announcement in the tone of one who presents, with careless assurance, a complete vindication. But Mrs. Fisher received it in a manner almost inconsequent. She seemed to have lost sight of her friend's part in the incident. Her inward vision had taken another slant. Bertha never turned up at all. Then how on earth did she get back? Oh, by the next train, I suppose. There were two extra ones for the fete. At any rate, I know she's safe on the yacht, though I haven't yet seen her. But you see, it was not my fault, Lily summed up. Not your fault that Bertha didn't turn up. My poor child, if only you don't have to pay for it. Mrs. Fisher rose. She had seen Mrs. Bry surging back in her direction. There's Louisa, and I must be off. Oh, we're on the best of terms, externally. We're lunching together. But at heart, it's me she's lunching on, she explained. And with a last handclasp and a last look, she added, Remember, I leave her to you. She's hovering now, ready to take you in. Lily carried the impression of Mrs. Fisher's leave-taking away with her from the casino doors. She had accomplished, before leaving, the first step toward her reinstatement in Mrs. Bry's good graces. An affable advance, a vague murmur that they must see more of each other, an elusive glance to a near future that was felt to include the Duchess as well as the Sabrina. How easily it was all done, if one possessed the knack of doing it. She wondered at herself, as she had so often wondered, that possessing the knack, she did not more consistently exercise it. But sometimes she was forgetful, and sometimes, could it be that she was proud? Today, at any rate, she had been vaguely conscious of a reason for sinking her pride, had in fact even sunk it to the point of suggesting to Lord Hubert Dacey, whom she ran across on the casino steps, that he might really get the Duchess to dine with the Brys if she undertook to have them asked on the Sabrina. Lord Hubert had promised his help with the readiness on which he could always count. It was his only way of ever reminding her that he had once been ready to do so much more for her. Her path, in short, seemed to smooth itself before her as she advanced. Yet the faint stir of uneasiness persisted. Had it been produced, she wondered, by her chance meeting with Selden? She thought not. Time and change seemed so completely to have relegated him to his proper distance. The sudden and exquisite reaction from her anxieties had had the effect of throwing the recent past so far back that even Selden, as part of it, retained a certain air of unreality. and he had made it so clear that they were not to meet again, that he had merely dropped down to Nice for a day or two, and had almost his foot on the next steamer. No, that part of the past had merely surged up for a moment on the fleeing surface of events, and now that it was submerged again, the uncertainty, the apprehension, persisted. They grew to sudden acuteness as she caught sight of George Dorset descending the steps of the Hotel de Paris and making for her across the square. She had meant to drive down to the quay and regain the yacht, but she now had the immediate impression that something more was to happen first. "Which way are you going? Shall we walk a bit?" he began, putting the second question before the first was answered, and not waiting for a reply to either, before he directed her silently toward the comparative seclusion of the lower gardens. She detected in him at once all the signs of extreme nervous tension. The skin was puffed out under his sunken eyes, and its sallowness had paled to a leaden white against which his irregular eyebrows and long reddish moustache were relieved with a saturnine effect. His appearance, in short, presented an odd mixture of the bedraggled and the ferocious. He walked beside her in silence with quick, precipitate steps, till they reached the embowered slopes to the east of the casino. Then, pulling up abruptly, he said, "Have you seen Bertha?" "No, when I left the yacht she was not yet up." He received this with the laugh like the whirring sound in a disabled clock. "Not yet up? Had she gone to bed? Do you know at what time she came on board? This morning at 7, he exclaimed. "At 7? Lily started. "What happened? An accident to the train?" He laughed again. "They missed the train, all the trains. They had to drive back." "Well," she hesitated, feeling at once how little even this necessity accounted for the fatal lapse of hours. "Well, they couldn't get a carriage at once, that time of night, you know." The explanatory note made it almost seem as though he were putting the case for his wife. "And when they finally did, it was only a one-horse cab, and the horse was lame." "How tiresome, I see," she affirmed with the more earnestness, because she was so nervously conscious that she did not. And after a pause she added, "I'm so sorry, but ought we to have waited?"
"Waited for the one-horse cab? It would scarcely have carried the four of us, do you think?"
She took this, in what seemed the only possible way, with a laugh intended to sink the question itself in his humorous treatment of it. "Well, it would have been difficult. We should have had to walk by turns. But it would have been jolly to see the sunrise."
"Yes, the sunrise was jolly," he agreed.
"Was it? You saw it, then?"
"I saw it, yes, from the deck. I waited up for them."
"Naturally, I suppose you were worried. Why didn't you call on me to share your vigil?" He stood still, dragging at his moustache with a lean, weak hand.
"I don't think you would have cared for its denouement," he said with sudden grimness.
Again she was disconcerted by the abrupt change in his tone, and as in one flash she saw the peril of the moment and the need of keeping her sense of it out of her eyes. "Denouement? Isn't that too big a word for such a small incident? The worst of it, after all, is the fatigue which Bertha's probably slept off by this time." She clung to the note bravely, though its futility was now plain to her in the glare of his miserable eyes.
Don't,
he broke out, with the hurt cry of a child. And while she tried to merge her sympathy and her resolve to ignore any cause for it in one ambiguous murmur of deprecation, he dropped down on the bench near which they had paused and poured out the wretchedness of his soul. It was a dreadful hour, an hour from which she emerged shrinking and seared, as though her lids had been scorched by its actual glare. It was not that she had never had premonitory glimpses of such an outbreak, but rather because here and there throughout the 3 months the surface of life had shown such ominous cracks and vapours that her fears had always been on the alert for an upheaval. There had been moments when the situation had presented itself under a homelier, yet more vivid image, that of a shaky vehicle dashed by unbroken steeds over a bumping road, while she cowered within, aware that the harness wanted mending, and wondering what would give way first. Well, everything had given way now, and the wonder was that the crazy outfit had held together so long. Her sense of being involved in the crash, instead of merely witnessing it from the road, was intensified by the way in which Dorset, through his furies of denunciation and wild reactions of self-contempt, made her feel the need he had of her, the place she had taken in his life.
But for her, what ear would have been open to his cries? And what hand but hers could drag him up again to a footing of sanity and self-respect? All through the stress of the struggle with him, she had been conscious of something faintly maternal in her efforts to guide and uplift him. But for the present, if he clung to her, it was not in order to be dragged up, but to feel someone floundering in the depths with him. He wanted her to suffer with him, not to help him to suffer less. Happily for both, there was little physical strength to sustain his frenzy. It left him, collapsed and breathing heavily, to an apathy so deep and prolonged that Lily almost feared the passers-by would think it the result of a seizure and stop to offer their aid. But Monte Carlo is, of all places, the one where the human bond is least close, and odd sights are the least arresting. If a glance or two lingered on the couple, no intrusive sympathy disturbed them, and it was Lily herself who broke the silence by rising from her seat. With the clearing of her vision, the sweep of peril had extended, and she saw that the post of danger was no longer at Dorset's side. "If you won't go back, I must. Don't make me leave you," she urged. But he remained mutely resistant, and she added, "What are you going to do? You really can't sit here all night." "I can go to an hotel. I can telegraph my lawyers." He sat up, roused by a new thought. "By Jove! Selden's at Nice. I'll send for Selden." Lily, at this, reseated herself with a cry of alarm. "No, no, no," she protested. He swung round on her distrustfully. "Why not, Selden? He's a lawyer, isn't he? One will do as well as another in a case like this." "As badly as another, you mean? I thought you relied on me to help you." "You do, by being so sweet and patient with me. If it hadn't been for you, I'd have ended the thing long ago. But now it's got to end." He rose suddenly, straightening himself with an effort. "You can't want to see me ridiculous." She looked at him kindly. "That's just it." Then, after a moment's pondering, almost to her own surprise, she broke out with a flash of inspiration. "Well, go over and see Mr. Selden. You'll have time to do it before dinner."
"Oh, dinner,"
he mocked her. But she left him with a smiling rejoinder. "Dinner on board, remember. We'll put it off till 9, if you like." It was past 4 already, and when a cab had dropped her at the quay and she stood waiting for the gig to put off for her, she began to wonder about what had been happening on the yacht. Of Silverton's whereabouts there had been no mention. Had he returned to the Sabrina? Or could Bertha... The dread alternative sprang on her suddenly. Could Bertha, left to herself, have gone ashore to rejoin him? Lily's heart stood still at the thought. All her concern had hitherto been for young Silverton, not only because in such affairs the woman's instinct is to side with the man, but because his case made a peculiar appeal to her sympathies. He was so desperately in earnest, poor youth, and his earnestness was of so different a quality from Bertha's, though hers too was desperate enough. The difference was that Bertha was in earnest only about herself, while he was in earnest about her. But now, at the actual crisis, this difference seemed to throw the weight of destitution on Bertha's side, since at least he had her to suffer for, and she had only herself. At any rate, viewed less ideally, all the disadvantages of such a situation were for the woman, and it was to Bertha that Lily's sympathies now went out. She was not fond of Bertha Dorset, but neither was she without a sense of obligation, the heavier for having so little personal liking to sustain it. Bertha had been kind to her. They had lived together during the last months on terms of easy friendship, and the sense of friction of which Lily had recently become aware seemed to make it the more urgent that she should work undividedly in her friend's interest. It was in Bertha's interest, certainly, that she had dispatched Dorset to consult with Lawrence Selden. Once the grotesqueness of the situation accepted, she had seen at a glance that it was the safest in which Dorset could find himself. Who but Selden could thus miraculously combine the skill to save Bertha with the obligation of doing so? The consciousness that much skill would be required made Lily rest thankfully in the greatness of the obligation. Since he would have to pull Bertha through, she could trust him to find a way. And she put the fullness of her trust in the telegram she managed to send him on her way to the quay. Thus far, then, Lily felt that she had done well, and the conviction strengthened her for the task that remained. She and Bertha had never been on confidential terms,
but at such a crisis the barriers of reserve must surely fall. Dorset's wild allusions to the scene of the morning made Lily feel that they were down already, and that any attempt to rebuild them would be beyond Bertha's strength. She pictured the poor creature shivering behind her fallen defences, and awaiting with suspense the moment when she could take refuge in the first shelter that offered. If only that shelter had not already offered itself elsewhere. As the gig traversed the short distance between the quay and the yacht, Lily grew more than ever alarmed at the possible consequences of her long absence. What if the wretched Bertha, finding in all the long hours no soul to turn to? But by this time Lily's eager foot was on the side ladder, and her first step on the Sabrina showed the worst of her apprehensions to be unfounded. For there, in the luxurious shade of the afterdeck, the wretched Bertha, in full command of her usual attenuated elegance, sat dispensing tea to the Duchess of Belcher and Lord Hubert. The sight filled Lily with such surprise that she felt that Bertha, at least, must read its meaning in her look, and she was proportionately disconcerted by the blankness of the look returned. But in an instant she saw that Mrs. Dorset had, of necessity, to look blank before the others, and that, to mitigate the effect of her own surprise, she must at once produce some simple reason for it. The long habit of rapid transitions made it easy for her to exclaim to the Duchess, "Why, I thought you'd gone back to the Princess." And this sufficed for the lady she addressed, if it was hardly enough for Lord Hubert. At least it opened the way to a lively explanation of how the Duchess was, in fact, going back the next moment, but it first rushed out to the yacht for a word with Mrs. Dorset on the subject of tomorrow's dinner, the dinner with the Brys, to which Lord Hubert had finally insisted on dragging them. "To save my neck, you know," he explained, with a glance that appealed to Lily for some recognition of his promptness. And the Duchess added with her noble candour, "Mr. Bry has promised him a tip, and he says if we go he'll pass it on to us." This led to some final pleasantries, in which, as it seemed to Lily, Mrs. Dorset bore her part with astounding bravery, and at the close of which Lord Hubert, from halfway down the side ladder, called back with an air of numbering heads, "And of course we may count on Dorset too." "Oh, count on him," his wife assented gaily. She was keeping up well to the last, but as she turned back from waving her adieu over the side, Lily said to herself that the mask must drop, and the soul of fear look out. Mrs. Dorset turned back slowly. Perhaps she wanted time to steady her muscles. At any rate, they were still under perfect control, when dropping once more into her seat behind the tea-table, she remarked to Miss Bart with a faint touch of irony, "I suppose I ought to say good morning." If it was a cue, Lily was ready to take it, though with only the vaguest sense of what was expected of her in return. There was something unnerving in the contemplation of Mrs. Dorset's composure, and she had to force the light tone in which she answered, "I tried to see you this morning, but you were not yet up." "No, I got to bed late. After we missed you at the station, I thought we ought to wait for you till the last train." She spoke very gently, but with just the least tinge of reproach. "You missed us? You waited for us at the station?" Now, indeed, Lily was too far adrift in bewilderment to measure the other's words or keep watch on her own. "But I thought you didn't get to the station till after the last train had left." Mrs. Dorset, examining her between lowered lids, met this with the immediate query, "Who told you that?" "George. I saw him just now in the gardens." "Ah, is that George's version? Poor George. He was in no state to remember what I told him. He had one of his worst attacks this morning, and I packed him off to see the doctor. Do you know if you found him?" Lily, still lost in conjecture, made no reply, and Mrs. Dorset settled herself indolently in her seat. "He'll wait to see him. He was horribly frightened about himself. It's very bad for him to be worried, and whenever anything upsetting happens, it always brings on an attack." This time Lily felt sure that a cue was being pressed on her, but it was put forth with such startling suddenness, and with so incredible an air of ignoring what it led up to, that she could only falter out doubtfully, "Anything upsetting?" "Yes, such as having you so conspicuously on his hands in the small hours. You know, my dear, you're rather a big responsibility in such a scandalous place after midnight." At that, at the complete unexpectedness and the inconceivable audacity of it, Lily could not restrain the tribute of an astonished laugh. "Oh, well, really,
considering it was you who burdened him with the responsibility.
Mrs. Dorset took this with an exquisite mildness. By not having the superhuman cleverness to discover you in that frightful rush for the train, or the imagination to believe that you'd take it without us, you and he all alone, instead of waiting quietly in the station till we did manage to meet you. Lily's colour rose. It was growing clear to her that Bertha was pursuing an object, following a line she had marked out for herself. Only with such a doom impending, why waste time in these childish efforts to avert it? The puerility of the attempt disarmed Lily's indignation. Did it not prove how horribly the poor creature was frightened? No, by our simply all keeping together at Nice, she returned. Keeping together? When it was you who seized the first opportunity to rush off with the Duchess and her friends? My dear Lily, you are not a child, to be led by the hand. No, nor to be lectured, Bertha, really, if that's what you are doing to me now. Mrs. Dorset smiled on her reproachfully. Lecture you? I? Heaven forbid! I was merely trying to give you a friendly hint. But it's usually the other way round, isn't it? I'm expected to take hints, not to give them. I've positively lived on them all these last months. Hints from me to you? Lily repeated. Oh, negative ones, merely. What not to be and to do and to see. And I think I've taken them to admiration. Only, my dear, if you'll let me say so. I didn't understand that one of my negative duties was not to warn you when you carried your imprudence too far. A chill of fear passed over Miss Bart, a sense of remembered treachery that was like the gleam of a knife in the dusk. But compassion, in a moment, got the better of her instinctive recoil. What was this outpouring of senseless bitterness but the tracked creature's attempt to cloud the medium through which it was fleeing? It was on Lily's lips to exclaim, "You poor soul, don't double and turn. Come straight back to me, and we'll find a way out." But the words died under the impenetrable insolence of Bertha's smile. Lily sat silent, taking the brunt of it quietly, letting it spend itself on her to the last drop of its accumulated falseness. Then, without a word, she rose and went down to her cabin. Chapter 3 Miss Bart's telegram caught Lawrence Selden at the door of his hotel, and having read it, he turned back to wait for Dorset. The message necessarily left large gaps for conjecture, but all that he had recently heard and seen made these but too easy to fill in. On the whole, he was surprised, for though he had perceived that the situation contained all the elements of an explosion, he had often enough, in the range of his personal experience, seen just such combinations subside into harmlessness. Still, Dorset's spasmodic temper and his wife's reckless disregard of appearances gave the situation a peculiar insecurity, and it was less from the sense of any special relation to the case than from a purely professional zeal that Selden resolved to guide the pair to safety. Whether, in the present instance, safety for either lay in repairing so damaged a tie, it was no business of his to consider. He had only, on general principles, to think of averting a scandal, and his desire to avert it was increased by his fear of its involving Miss Bart. There was nothing specific in this apprehension. He merely wished to spare her the embarrassment of being ever so remotely connected with the public washing of the Dorset linen. How exhaustive and unpleasant such a process would be, he saw even more vividly after his 2 hours' talk with poor Dorset. If anything came out at all, it would be such a vast unpacking of accumulated moral rags, as left him, after his visitor had gone, with the feeling that he must fling open the windows and have his room swept out. But nothing should come out, and happily for his side of the case, the dirty rags, however pieced together, could not, without considerable difficulty, be turned into a homogeneous grievance. The torn edges did not always fit. There were missing bits. There were disparities of size and colour, all of which it was naturally Selden's business to make the most of in putting them under his client's eye. But to a man in Dorset's mood, the completest demonstration could not carry conviction, and Selden saw that for the moment all he could do was to soothe and temporise, to offer sympathy and to counsel prudence. He let Dorset depart, charged to the brim with the sense that till their next meeting he must maintain a strictly non-committal attitude, that in short his share in the game consisted for the present in looking on. Selden knew, however, that he could not long keep such violences in equilibrium, and he promised to meet Dorset the next morning at an hotel in Monte Carlo. Meanwhile, he counted not a little on the reaction of weakness and self-distrust that in such natures follows on every unwonted expenditure of moral force. And his telegraphic reply to Miss Bart consisted simply in the injunction, "Assume that everything is as usual." On this assumption, in fact, the early part of the following day was lived through. Dorset, as if in obedience to Lily's imperative bidding, had actually returned in time for a late dinner on the yacht. The repast had been the most difficult moment of the day. Dorset was sunk in one of the abysmal silences which so commonly followed on what his wife called his attacks, that it was easy, before the servants, to refer it to this cause. But Bertha herself seemed, perversely enough, little disposed to make use of this obvious means of protection. She simply left the brunt of the situation on her husband's hands, as if too absorbed in a grievance of her own to suspect that she might be the object of one herself. To Lily this attitude was the most ominous, because the most perplexing, element in the situation. As she tried to fan the weak flicker of talk, to build up again and again the crumbling structure of appearances, her own attention was perpetually distracted by the question, "What on earth can she be driving at?" There was something positively exasperating in Bertha's attitude of isolated defiance. If only she would have given her friend a hint, they might still have worked together successfully. But how could Lily be of use while she was thus obstinately shut out from participation? To be of use was what she honestly wanted, and not for her own sake, but for the Dorsets. She had not thought of her own situation at all. She was simply engrossed in trying to put a little order in theirs. But the close of the short, dreary evening left her with a sense of effort hopelessly wasted. She had not tried to see Dorset alone. She had positively shrunk from a renewal of his confidences. It was Bertha whose confidence she sought, and who should as eagerly have invited her own. And Bertha, as if in the infatuation of self-destruction, was actually pushing away her rescuing hand. Lily, going to bed early, had left the couple to themselves, and it seemed part of the general mystery in which she moved that more than an hour should elapse before she heard Bertha walk down the silent passage and regain her room. The morrow, rising on an apparent continuance of the same conditions, revealed nothing of what had occurred between the confronted pair. One fact alone outwardly proclaimed the change they were all conspiring to ignore, and that was the non-appearance of Ned Silverton. No one referred to it, and this tacit avoidance of the subject kept it in the immediate foreground of consciousness. But there was another change, perceptible only to Lily, and that was that Dorset now avoided her almost as pointedly as his wife. Perhaps he was repenting his rash outpourings of the previous day, perhaps only trying in his clumsy way to conform to Selden's counsel to behave as usual. Such instructions no more make for easiness of attitude than the photographer's behest to look natural, and in a creature as unconscious as poor Dorset of the appearance he habitually presented, the struggle to maintain a pose was sure to result in queer contortions. It resulted, at any rate, in throwing Lily strangely on her own resources. She had learned on leaving her room that Mrs. Dorset was still invisible, and that Dorset had left the yacht early. And feeling too restless to remain alone, she too had herself ferried ashore. Straying toward the casino, she attached herself to a group of acquaintances from Nice with whom she lunched, and in whose company she was returning to the rooms when she encountered Selden crossing the square. She could not at the moment separate herself definitely from her party, who had hospitably assumed that she would remain with them till they took their departure. But she found time for a momentary pause of inquiry, to which she promptly returned, "I've seen him again. He's just left me." She waited before him anxiously. "Well, what has happened? What will happen?"
"Nothing as yet, and nothing in the future, I think."
"It's over, then. It's settled. You're sure?"
He smiled. "Give me time. I'm not sure, but I'm a good deal surer." And with that she had to content herself, and hasten on to the expectant group on the steps.
Selden had in fact given her the utmost measure of his sureness, had even stretched it a shade, to meet the anxiety in her eyes. And now as he turned away, strolling down the hill toward the station,
That anxiety remained with him as the visible justification of his own. It was not indeed anything specific that he feared. There had been a literal truth in his declaration that he did not think anything would happen. What troubled him was that though Dorset's attitude had perceptibly changed, the change was not clearly to be accounted for. It had certainly not been produced by Selden's arguments or by the action of his own soberer reason. 5 minutes' talk sufficed to show that some alien influence had been at work, and that it had not so much subdued his resentment as weakened his will, so that he moved under it in a state of apathy, like a dangerous lunatic who has been drugged. Temporarily, no doubt, however exerted, it worked for the general safety. The question was how long it would last, and by what kind of reaction it was likely to be followed. On these points Selden could gain no light, for he saw that one effect of the transformation had been to shut him off from free communion with Dorset. The latter, indeed, was still moved by the irresistible desire to discuss his wrong, but though he revolved about it with the same forlorn tenacity, Selden was aware that something always restrained him from full expression. His state was one to produce first weariness and then impatience in his hearer, and when their talk was over, Selden began to feel that he had done his utmost and might justifiably wash his hands of the sequel. It was in this mind that he had been making his way back to the station when Miss Bart crossed his path. But though, after his brief word with her, he kept mechanically on his course, he was conscious of a gradual change in his purpose. The change had been produced by the look in her eyes, and in his eagerness to define the nature of that look, he dropped into a seat in the gardens and sat brooding upon the question. It was natural enough, in all conscience, that she should appear anxious. A young woman placed in the close intimacy of a yachting cruise between a couple on the verge of disaster could hardly, aside from her concern for her friends, be insensible to the awkwardness of her own position. The worst of it was that in interpreting Miss Bard's state of mind so many alternative readings were possible, and one of them, in Selden's troubled mind, took the ugly form suggested by Mrs. Fisher. If the girl was afraid, was she afraid for herself or for her friends? And to what degree was her dread of a catastrophe intensified by the sense of being fatally involved in it? The burden of offence lying manifestly with Mrs. Dorset. This conjecture seemed, on the face of it, gratuitously unkind. But Selden knew that in the most one-sided matrimonial quarrel there are generally countercharges to be brought, and that they are brought with the greater audacity where the original grievance is so emphatic. Mrs. Fisher had not hesitated to suggest the likelihood of Dorset's marrying Miss Bart if anything happened, and though Mrs. Fisher's conclusions were notoriously rash, she was shrewd enough in reading the signs from which they were drawn. Dorset had apparently shown marked interest in the girl, and this interest might be used to cruel advantage in his wife's struggle for rehabilitation. Selden knew that Bertha would fight to the last round of powder. The rashness of her conduct was illogically combined with a cold determination to escape its consequences. She could be as unscrupulous in fighting for herself as she was reckless in courting danger, and whatever came to her hand at such moments was likely to be used as a defensive missile. He did not as yet see clearly just what course she was likely to take, but his perplexity increased his apprehension, and with it the sense that before leaving he must speak again with Miss Bart. Whatever her share in the situation, and he had always honestly tried to resist judging her by her surroundings, however free she might be from any personal connection with it, she would be better out of the way of a possible crash, and since she had appealed to him for help, it was clearly his business to tell her so. This decision at last brought him to his feet and carried him back to the gambling rooms, within whose doors he had seen her disappearing. But a prolonged exploration of the crowd failed to put him on her traces. He saw instead, to his surprise, Ned Silverton loitering somewhat ostentatiously about the tables, and the discovery that this actor in the drama was not only hovering in the wings, but actually inviting the exposure of the footlights, though it might have seemed to imply that all peril was over, served rather to deepen Selden's sense of foreboding. Charged with this impression, he returned to the square, hoping to see Miss Bart move across it, as everyone in Monte Carlo seemed inevitably to do at least a dozen times a day. But here again he waited vainly for a glimpse of her, and the conclusion was slowly forced on him that she had gone back to the Sabrina. It would be difficult to follow her there, and still more difficult, should he do so, to contrive the opportunity for a private word. And he had almost decided on the unsatisfactory alternative of writing, when the ceaseless diorama of the square suddenly unrolled before him the figures of Lord Hubert and Mrs. Bry. Hailing them at once with his question, he learned from Lord Hubert that Miss Bart had just returned to the Sabrina in Dorset's company, an announcement so evidently disconcerting to him that Mrs. Bry, after a glance from her companion which seemed to act like the pressure on a spring, brought forth the prompt proposal that he should come and meet his friends at dinner that evening. "At Becassin's, a little dinner to the Duchess," she flashed out, before Lord Hubert had time to remove the pressure. Selden's sense of the privilege of being included in such company brought him early in the evening to the door of the restaurant, where he paused to scan the ranks of diners approaching down the brightly lit terrace. There, while the Brys hovered within over the last agitating alternatives of the menu, he kept watch for the guests from the Sabrina, who at length rose on the horizon in company with the Duchess, Lord and Lady Skiddaw, and the Stepneys. From this group it was easy for him to detach Miss Bart on the pretext of a moment's glance into one of the brilliant shops along the terrace, and to say to her while they lingered together in the white dazzle of a jeweller's window, "I stopped over to see you, to beg of you to leave the yacht." The eyes she turned on him showed a quick gleam of her former fear. "To leave? What do you mean? What has happened?" "Nothing. But if anything should, why be in the way of it?" The glare from the jeweller's window, deepening the pallor of her face, gave to its delicate lines the sharpness of a tragic mask. "Nothing will, I'm sure. But while there's even a doubt left, how can you think I would leave Bertha?" The words rang out on a note of contempt. Was it possibly of contempt for himself? Well, he was willing to risk its renewal to the extent of insisting, with an undeniable throb of added interest, "You have yourself to think of, you know." To which, with a strange fall of sadness in her voice, she answered, meeting his eyes, "If you knew how little difference that makes." "Oh, well, nothing will happen," he said, more for his own reassurance than for hers. "And nothing, nothing, of course," she valiantly assented, as they turned to overtake their companions. In the thronged restaurant, taking their places about Mrs. Bry's illuminated board, their confidence seemed to gain support from the familiarity of their surroundings. Here were Dorset and his wife once more presenting their customary faces to the world, she engrossed in establishing her relation with an intensely new gown, he shrinking with dyspeptic dread from the multiplied solicitations of the menu. The mere fact that they thus showed themselves together with the utmost openness the place afforded seemed to declare beyond a doubt that their differences were composed. How this end had been attained was still matter for wonder, but it was clear that for the moment Miss Bart rested confidently in the result, and Selden tried to achieve the same view by telling himself that her opportunities for observation had been ampler than his own. Meanwhile, as the dinner advanced through a labyrinth of courses in which it became clear that Mrs. Bry had occasionally broken away from Lord Hubert's restraining hand, Selden's general watchfulness began to lose itself in a particular study of Miss Bart. It was one of the days when she was so handsome that to be handsome was enough, and all the rest, her grace, her quickness, her social felicities, seemed the overflow of a bounteous nature. But what especially struck him was the way in which she detached herself by 100 undefinable shades from the persons who most abounded in her own style. It was in just such company, the fine flower and complete expression of the state she aspired to, that the differences came out with special poignancy, her grace cheapening the other women's smartness as her finely discriminated silences made their chatter dull. The strain of the last hours had restored to her face the deeper eloquence which Selden had lately missed in it, and the bravery of her words to him still fluttered in her voice and eyes. Yes, she was matchless. It was the one word for her, and he could give his admiration the freer play because so little personal feeling remained in it. His real detachment from her had taken place not at the lurid moment of disenchantment, but now, in the sober afterlight of discrimination, where he saw her definitely divided from him by the crudeness of a choice which seemed to deny the very differences he felt in her. It was before him again in its completeness, the choice in which he was content to rest, in the stupid costliness of the food and the showy dullness of the talk, in the freedom of speech which never arrived at wit, and the freedom of act which never made for romance. The strident setting of the restaurant, in which their table seemed set apart in a special glare of publicity, and the present added of little Dabham of the Riviera Notes, emphasized the ideals of a world where conspicuousness passed for distinction, and the society column had become the role of fame. It was as the immortalizer of such occasions that little Dabham, wedged in modest watchfulness between two brilliant neighbors, suddenly became the center of Selden's scrutiny. How much did he know of what was going on, and how much for his purpose was still worth finding out? His little eyes were like tentacles thrown out to catch the floating intimations with which to Selden the air at moments seemed thick. Then again it cleared to its normal emptiness, and he could see nothing in it for the journalist but leisure to note the elegance of the ladies' gowns. Mrs. Dorset's, in particular, challenged all the wealth of Mr. Dabham's vocabulary. It had surprises and subtleties worthy of what he would have called literary style. At first, as Selden had noticed, it had been almost too preoccupying to its wearer. But now she was in full command of it, and was even producing her effects with unwonted freedom. Was she not, indeed, too free, too fluent for perfect naturalness? And was not Dorset, to whom his glance had passed by a natural transition, too jerkily wavering between the same extremes? Dorset, indeed, was always jerky, but it seemed to Selden that tonight each vibration swung him farther from his centre. The dinner, meanwhile, was moving to its triumphant close, to the evident satisfaction of Mrs. Bry, who, throned in apoplectic majesty between Lord Skiddaw and Lord Hubert, seemed in spirit to be calling on Mrs. Fisher to witness her achievement. Short of Mrs. Fisher, her audience might have been called complete, for the restaurant was crowded with persons mainly gathered there for the purpose of spectatorship, and accurately posted as to the names and faces of the celebrities they had come to see. Mrs. Bry, conscious that all her feminine guests came under that heading, and that each one looked her part to admiration, shone on Lily with all the pent-up gratitude that Mrs. Fisher had failed to deserve. Selden, catching the glance, wondered what part Miss Bart had played in organizing the entertainment. She did at least a great deal to adorn it, and as he watched the bright security with which she bore herself, he smiled to think that he should have fancied her in need of help. Never had she appeared more serenely mistress of the situation than when, at the moment of dispersal, detaching herself a little from the group about the table, she turned with a smile and a graceful slant of the shoulders to receive her cloak from Dorset. The dinner had been protracted over Mr. Bry's exceptional cigars and a bewildering array of liqueurs, and many of the other tables were empty. But a sufficient number of diners still lingered to give relief to the leave-taking of Mrs. Bry's distinguished guests. This ceremony was drawn out and complicated by the fact that it involved, on the part of the Duchess and Lady Skiddaw, definite farewells and pledges of speedy reunion in Paris, where they were to pause and replenish their wardrobes on the way to England. The quality of Mrs. Bry's hospitality, and of the tips her husband had presumably imparted, lent to the manner of the English ladies a general effusiveness which shed the rosiest light over their hostess's future. In its glow, Mrs. Dorset and the Stepneys were also visibly included, and the whole scene had touches of intimacy worth their weight in gold to the watchful pen of Mr. Dabham. A glance at her watch caused the Duchess to exclaim to her sister that they had just time to dash for their train, and the flurry of this departure over, the Stepneys, who had their motor at the door, offered to convey the Dorsets and Miss Bart to the quay. The offer was accepted, and Mrs. Dorset moved away with her husband in attendance. Miss Bart had lingered for a last word with Lord Hubert, and Stepney, on whom Mr. Bry was pressing a final and still more expensive cigar, called out, "Come on, Lily, if you're going back to the yacht." Lily turned to obey, but as she did so, Mrs. Dorset, who had paused on her way out, moved a few steps back toward the table. "Miss Bart is not going back to the yacht," she said, in a voice of singular distinctness. A startled look ran from eye to eye. Mrs. Bry crimsoned to the verge of congestion. Mrs. Stepney slipped nervously behind her husband, and Selden, in the general turmoil of his sensations, was mainly conscious of a longing to grip Dabham by the collar and fling him out into the street.
Dorset, meanwhile, had stepped back to his wife's side. His face was white, and he looked about him with cowed, angry eyes.
"Bertha, Miss Bart, this is some misunderstanding, some mistake."
"Miss Bart remains here," his wife rejoined incisively. "And I think, George, we had better not detain Mrs. Stepney any longer."
Miss Bart, during this brief exchange of words, remained in admirable erectness, slightly isolated from the embarrassed group about her. She had paled a little under the shock of the insult, but the discomposure of the surrounding faces was not reflected in her own. The faint disdain of her smile seemed to lift her high above her antagonist's reach, and it was not till she had given Mrs. Dorset the full measure of the distance between them that she turned and extended her hand to her hostess. "I'm joining the Duchess tomorrow," she explained, "and it seemed easier for me to remain on shore for the night." She held firmly to Mrs. Bry's wavering eye while she gave this explanation, but when it was over, Selden saw her send a tentative glance from one to another of the women's faces. She read their incredulity in their averted looks, and in the mute wretchedness of the men behind them, and for a miserable half-second he thought she quivered on the brink of failure. Then, turning to him with an easy gesture and the pale bravery of her recovered smile, "Dear Mr. Selden," she said, "you promised to see me to my cab." Outside, the sky was gusty and overcast, and as Lillian Selden moved toward the deserted gardens below the restaurant, spurts of warm rain blew fitfully against their faces. The fiction of the cab had been tacitly abandoned. They walked on in silence, her hand on his arm, till the deeper shade of the gardens received them. And pausing beside a bench, he said, "Sit down a moment." She dropped to the seat without answering, but the electric lamp at the bend of the path shed a gleam on the struggling misery of her face. Selden sat down beside her, waiting for her to speak, fearful lest any word he chose should touch too roughly on her wound, and kept also from free utterance by the wretched doubt which had slowly renewed itself within him. What had brought her to this pass? What weakness had placed her so abominably at her enemy's mercy? And why should Bertha Dorset have turned into an enemy at the very moment when she so obviously needed the support of her sex? Even while his nerves raged at the subjection of husbands to their wives and at the cruelty of women to their kind, reason obstinately harped on the proverbial relation between smoke and fire. The memory of Mrs. Fisher's hints and the corroboration of his own impressions, while they deepened his pity, also increased his constraint, since whichever way he sought a free outlet for sympathy, it was blocked by the fear of committing a blunder. Suddenly it struck him that his silence must seem almost as accusatory of that of the men he had despised for turning from her. But before he could find the fitting words, she had cut him short with a question. "Do you know of a quiet hotel? I can send for my maid in the morning."
"An hotel, here, that you can go to alone? It's not possible."
She met this with a pale gleam of her old playfulness. "What is, then? It's too wet to sleep in the gardens."
"But there must be someone..."
"Someone to whom I can go?"
"Of course, any number. But at this hour..."
"You see, my change of plan was rather sudden."
"Good God, if you'd listened to me," he cried, venting his helplessness in a burst of anger.
She still held him off with the gentle mockery of her smile.
"But haven't I?" she rejoined. "You advised me to leave the yacht, and I'm leaving it."
He saw then, with a pang of self-reproach, that she meant neither to explain nor to defend herself, that by his miserable silence he had forfeited all chance of helping her, and that the decisive hour was past. She had risen and stood before him in a kind of clouded majesty, like some deposed princess moving tranquilly to exile.
"Lily,"
he exclaimed, with a note of despairing appeal, "but, oh, not now," she gently admonished him. And then, in all the sweetness of her recovered composure, "since I must find shelter somewhere, and since you're so kindly here to help me..." He gathered himself up at the challenge.
"You will do as I tell you. There's but one thing, then. You must go straight to your cousins, the Stepneys."
"Oh!"
broke from her with a movement of instinctive resistance. But he insisted,
"Come, it's late, and you must appear to have gone there directly."
He had drawn her hand into his arm, but she held him back with a last gesture of protest.
"I can't.
I can't, not that. You don't know, Gwen. You mustn't ask me.
I must ask you. You must obey me, he persisted, though infected at heart by her own fear. Her voice sank to a whisper. And if she refuses? But, oh, trust me, he could only insist in return. And yielding to his touch, she let him lead her back in silence to the edge of the square. In the cab, they continued to remain silent through the brief drive which carried them to the illuminated portals of the Stepney's hotel. Here he left her outside, in the darkness of the raised hood, while his name was sent up to Stepney, and he paced the showy hall, awaiting the latter's descent. Then, minutes later, the two men passed out together between the gold-laced custodians of the threshold. But in the vestibule, Stepney drew up with a last flare of reluctance. "It's understood, then," he stipulated nervously, with his hand on Selden's arm. "She leaves tomorrow by the early train, and my wife's asleep and can't be disturbed." Chapter 4. The blinds of Mrs. Peniston's drawing-room were drawn down against the oppressive June sun, and in the sultry twilight the faces of her assembled relatives took on a fitting shadow of bereavement. They were all there, Van Alstyne's, Stepney's, and Melson's, even a stray Peniston or two, indicating by a greater latitude in dress and manner the fact of remoter relationship and more settled hopes. The Peniston side was, in fact, secure in the knowledge that the bulk of Mr. Peniston's property went back, while the direct connection hung suspended on the disposal of his widow's private fortune, and on the uncertainty of its extent. Jack Stepney, in his new character as the richest nephew, tacitly took the lead, emphasizing his importance by the deeper gloss of his mourning and the subdued authority of his manner, while his wife's bored attitude and frivolous gown proclaimed the heiress's disregard of the insignificant interests at stake. Old Ned Van Alstyne, seated next to her, in a coat that made affliction dapper, twirled his white moustache to conceal the eager twitch of his lips, and Grace Stepney, red-nosed and smelling of crepe, whispered emotionally to Mrs. Herbert Melson, "I couldn't bear to see the Niagara anywhere else." A rustle of weeds and quick turning of heads hailed the opening of the door, and Lily Bart appeared, tall and noble in her black dress, with Gertie Farish at her side. The women's faces, as she paused interrogatively on the threshold, were a study in hesitation. One or two made faint motions of recognition, which might have been subdued either by the solemnity of the scene or by the doubt as to how far the others meant to go. Mrs. Jack Stepney gave a careless nod, and Grace Stepney, with a sepulchral gesture, indicated a seat at her side. But Lily, ignoring the invitation as well as Jack Stepney's official attempt to direct her, moved across the room with her smooth, free gait, and seated herself in a chair which seemed to have been purposely placed apart from the others.